11. Escape along the strips. Bailey's grip tightened convulsively on his fork. Are you sure? He asked automatically, and as he said it, he realized the uselessness of the question. You don't ask a computer if it is sure of the answer it disgorges. Not even a computer with arms and legs. R. Daniel said, quite. Are they close to us? Not very. They are scattered. All right, then. Bailey returned to his meal, his fork moving mechanically. Behind the frown on his long face, his mind worked furiously. Suppose the incident last night had been organized by a group of anti-robot fanatics, that it had not been the spontaneous trouble that it seemed. Such a group of agitators could easily include men who had studied robots with the intensity born of deep opposition. One of them might have recognized R. Daniel for what he was. The commissioner had suggested that, in a way. Damn it, there were surprising depths to... It worked itself out logically. Granting they had been enabled to act in an organized manner on the spur of last evening's moment, they would still have been able to plan for the future. If they could recognize a robot such as R. Daniel, they could certainly realize that Bailey himself was a police officer. A police officer in the unusual company of a humanoid robot would very likely be a responsible man in the organization. With the wisdom of hindsight, Bailey followed the line of reasoning with no trouble at all. It followed, then, that observers at City Hall, or perhaps agents within City Hall, would be bound to spot Bailey, R. Daniel, or both, before too long a time had passed. That they had done so within 24 hours was not surprising. They might have done so in less time if so much of Bailey's day had not been spent in Spacetown and along the motorway. R. Daniel had finished his meal. He sat quietly waiting, his perfect hands resting lightly on the end of the table. Had we not better do something? He asked. We're safe here in the kitchen, said Bailey. Now leave this to me, please. Bailey looked about him cautiously, and it was as though he saw a kitchen for the first time. People. Thousands of them. What was the capacity of an average kitchen? He had once seen the figure. 2,200, he thought. This one was larger than average. Suppose the cry, robot, were sent out into the air. Suppose it were tossed among the thousands like a... He was at a loss for a comparison. But it didn't matter. It wouldn't happen. A spontaneous riot could flare anywhere, in the kitchens as easily as in the corridors or in the elevators. More easily, perhaps. There was a lack of inhibition at mealtimes, a sense of horseplay that could degenerate into something more serious at a trifle. But a planned riot would be different. Here in the kitchen, the planners would themselves be trapped in a large and mob-filled room. Once the dishes went flying and the tables cracking, there would be no easy way to escape. Hundreds would certainly die, and they themselves might easily be among them. No. A safe riot would have to be planned in the avenues of the city, in some relatively narrow passageway. Panic and hysteria would travel slowly along the constriction, and there would be time for the quick, prepared fadeaway along the side passage or the unobtrusive step onto an escalating local way that would move them to a higher level and disappearance. Bailey felt trapped. There were probably others waiting outside. Bailey and R. Daniel were to be followed to a proper point, and the fuse would be set off. R. Daniel said, why not arrest them? That would only start the trouble sooner. You know their faces, don't you? You won't forget. I'm not capable of forgetting. Then we'll nab them another time. For now, we'll break their net. Follow me. Do exactly as I do. He rose, turned his dish carefully upside down, centering it on the movable disc from below which it had risen. He put his fork back in its recess. R. Daniel watching matched his action. The dishes and utensils dropped out of sight. R. Daniel said, they are getting up, too. All right. It's my feeling they won't get too close. Not here. The two moved into line now, drifting toward an exit where the click, click, click of the tag sounded ritualistically, each click recording the expenditure of a ration unit. Bailey looked back through the steamy haze and the noise and, with incongruous sharpness, thought of a visit to the city zoo with Ben 6 or 7 years ago. No, 8, because Ben had just passed his 8th birthday then. Jehoshaphat. Where did the time go? It had been Ben's first visit, and he had been excited. After all, he had never actually seen a cat or a dog before. Then on top of that, there was the birdcage. Even Bailey himself, who had seen it a dozen times before, was not immune to its fascination. There is something about the first sight of living objects hurtling through air that is incomparably startling. It was feeding time in the sparrow cage, and an attendant was dumping cracked oats into a long trough. Human beings had grown used to yeast substitutes, but animals, more conservative in their way, insisted on real grain. The sparrows flocked down in what seemed like hundreds, wing to wing, with an ear-splitting twitter. They lined the trough. That was it. That was the picture that came to Bailey's mind as he looked back at the kitchen he was leaving. Sparrows at the trough. The thought repelled him. He thought, Jehoshaphat, there must be a better way. But what better way? What was wrong with this way? It had never bothered him before. He said abruptly to our Daniil, Ready, Daniil? I am ready, Elijah. They left the kitchen, and escape was now clearly and flatly up to Bailey. There is a game that youngsters know called Running the Strips. Its rules vary in trivial fashion from city to city, but its essentials are eternal. A boy from San Francisco can join the game in Cairo with no trouble. Its object is to get from point A to point B via the city's rapid transit system in such a way that the leader manages to lose as many of his followers as possible. A leader who arrives at the destination alone is skillful indeed, as is a follower who refuses to be shaken. The game is usually conducted during the evening rush hour, when the increased density of the commuters makes it at once more hazardous and more complicated. The leader sets off, running up and down the accelerating strips. He does his best to do the unexpected, remaining standing on a given strip as long as possible, then leaping off suddenly in either direction. He will run quickly through several strips, then remain waiting once more. Pity the follower who incautiously careens forward one strip too far. Before he has caught his mistake, unless he is extraordinarily nimble, he has driven past the leader or fallen behind. The clever leader will compound the error by moving quickly in the appropriate direction. A move designed to increase the complexity of the task tenfold involves boarding the local ways or the expressways themselves and hurtling off the other side. It is bad form to avoid them completely, and also bad form to linger on them. The attraction of the game is not easy for an adult to understand, particularly for an adult who has never himself been a teenage strip runner. The players are roughly treated by legitimate travelers into whose path they find themselves inevitably flying. They are persecuted bitterly by the police and punished by their parents. They are denounced in the schools and on the subetherics. No year passes without its four or five teenagers killed at the game, its dozens hurt. Its cases of innocent bystanders meeting tragedy of varying degree. Yet nothing can be done to wipe out the strip-running gangs. The greater the danger, the more the strip-runners have that most valuable of all prizes, honor in the eyes of their fellows. A successful one may well swagger. A well-known leader is cock of the walk. Elijah Bailey, for instance, remembered with satisfaction, even now, that he had been a strip runner once. He had led a gang of 20 from the Concourse sector to the borders of Queens, crossing three expressways. In two tireless and relentless hours, he had shaken off some of the most agile followers of the Bronx and arrived at the destination point alone. They talked about that run for months. Bailey was in his 40s now, of course. He hadn't run the strips for over 20 years, but he remembered some of the tricks. What he had lost in agility, he made up in another respect. He was a policeman. No one but another policeman, as experienced as himself, could possibly know the city as well. Know where almost every metal-bordered alley began and ended. He walked away from the kitchen briskly, but not too rapidly. Each moment, he expected the cry of, Robot! Robot! To ring out behind him. That initial set of moments was the riskiest. He counted the steps until he felt the first accelerating strip moving under him. He stopped for a moment while our Daniil moved smoothly up beside him. Are they still behind us, Daniil? Asked Bailey in a whisper. Yes, they're moving closer. That won't last, said Bailey confidently. He looked at the strips stretching to either side, with their human cargo whipping to his left more and more rapidly as their distance from him increased. He had felt the strips beneath his feet many times a day, almost all the days of his life. But he had not bent his knees in anticipation of running them in 7,000 days and more. He felt the old familiar thrill, and his breath grew more rapid. He quite forgot the one time he had caught Ben at the game. He had lectured him interminably and threatened to have him put under police surveillance. Lightly, quickly, at double the safe rate, he went up the strips. He leaned forward sharply against the acceleration. The local way was humming past. For a moment, it looked as though he would mount. But suddenly he was fading backward, backward, dodging through the crowd to left and right as it thickened on the slower strips. He stopped and let himself be carried along at a mere 15 miles an hour. "How many are with us, Daniil?"
"Only one, Elijah."
The robot was at his side, unruffled, unbreathing. "He must have been a good one in his day, too, but he won't last either." Full of self-confidence, he felt a half-remembered sensation of his younger days. It consisted partly of the feeling of immersion in a mystic rite to which others did not belong, partly of the purely physical sensation of wind against hair and face, partly of a tenuous sense of danger.
"They call this the side shuffle," he said to R. Daniil in a low voice.
His long stride ate distance, but he moved along a single strip, dodging the legitimate crowd with a minimum of effort. He kept it up, moving always closer to the strip's edge, until the steady movement of his head through the crowd must have been hypnotic in its constant velocity, as it was intended to be. And then, without a break in his step, he shifted 2 inches sideways and was on the adjoining strip. He felt an aching in his thigh muscles as he kept his balance. He whipped through a cluster of commuters and was on the 45-mile strip.
"How is it now, Daniil?" he asked.
"He is still with us," was the calm answer. Bailey's lips tightened. There was nothing for it but to use the moving platforms themselves, and that really required coordination, more perhaps than he still retained. He looked about quickly. Exactly where were they now? B-22D Street flashed by. He made rapid calculations and was off. Up the remaining strips, smoothly and steadily, a swing onto the local way platform. The impersonal faces of men and women, calloused with the ennui of wayriding, were jolted into something like indignation as Bailey and R. Daniil clambered aboard and squeezed through the railings.
"Hey now!"
called a woman shrilly, clutching at her hat.
"Sorry,"
said Bailey breathlessly. He forced his way through the standees and with a wriggle was off on the other side. At the last moment, a jostled passenger thumped his back in anger. He went staggering. Desperately, he tried to regain his footing. He lurched across a strip boundary, and the sudden change in velocity forced him to his knees and then over to his side. He had the sudden panicky vision of men colliding with him and bowling over, of a spreading confusion on the strips, one of the dreaded man-jams that would not fail to put dozens in the hospital with broken limbs. But R. Daniil's arm was under his back. He felt himself lifted with more than a man's strength.
"Thanks,"
gasped Bailey, and there was no time for more. Off he went and down the decelerating strips in a complicated pattern so designed that his feet met the V-joint strips of an expressway at the exact point of crossover. Without the loss of rhythm, he was accelerating again, then up and over an expressway.
"Is he with us, Daniil?"
"Not one in sight, Elijah."
"Good. But what a strip runner you would have been, Daniil. Whoops, now!
Off into another local way in a whirl and down the strips with a clatter to a doorway, large and official in appearance. A guard rose to his feet. Bailey flashed his identification.
"Official business."
They were inside.
"Power plant,"
said Bailey curtly. "This breaks our tracks completely." He had been in power plants before, including this one. Familiarity did not lessen his feelings of uncomfortable awe. The feeling was heightened by the haunting thought that once his father had been high in the hierarchy of a plant such as this. That is, before. There was the surrounding hum of the tremendous generators hidden in the central well of the plant, the faint sharpness of ozone in the air, the grim and silent threat of the red lines that marked the limits beyond which no one could pass without protective clothing. Somewhere in the plant, Bailey had no idea exactly where, a pound of fissionable material was consumed each day. Every so often, the radioactive fission products, the so-called hot ash, were forced by air pressure through leaden pipes to distant caverns 10 miles out in the ocean, and a half mile below the ocean floor. Bailey sometimes wondered what would happen when the caverns were filled. He said to R. Daniil with sudden gruffness, "Stay away from the red lines." Then he bethought himself and added sheepishly, "But I suppose it doesn't matter to you." "Is it a question of radioactivity?" asked Daniil. "Yes." "Then it does matter to me. Gamma radiation destroys the delicate balance of a positronic brain. It would affect me much sooner than it would affect you."
"You mean it would kill you?"
"I would require a new positronic brain. Since no two can be alike, I would be a new individual. The Daniil you now speak to would be, in a manner of speaking, dead." Bailey looked at the other doubtfully.
"I never knew that.
Up these ramps." The point isn't stressed. Spacetown wishes to convince Earthmen of the usefulness of such as myself, not of our weaknesses.
"Then why tell me?"
R. Daniil turned his eyes full on his human companion.
"You are my partner, Elijah. It is well that you know my weaknesses and shortcomings."
Bailey cleared his throat and had nothing more to say on the subject. "Out in this direction," he said a moment later, "and we're a quarter of a mile from our apartment." It was a grim, lower-class apartment. One small room and two beds. Two folding chairs in a closet. A built-in subetheric screen that allowed no manual adjustment, and would be working only at stated hours, but would be working then. No wash basin, not even an unactivated one, and no facilities for cooking or even boiling water. A small trash disposal pipe was in one corner of the room, an ugly, unadorned, unpleasantly functional object. Bailey shrugged.
"This is it. I guess we can stand it."
R. Daniil walked to the trash disposal pipe, his shirt unseamed at a touch, revealing a smooth and, to all appearances, well-muscled chest.
"What are you doing?" asked Bailey.
"Getting rid of the food I ingested. If I were to leave it, it would putrefy, and I would become an object of distaste." R. Daniil placed two fingers carefully under one nipple and pushed in a definite pattern of pressure. His chest opened longitudinally. R. Daniil reached in and from a welter of gleaming metal withdrew a thin, translucent sack, partly distended. He opened it while Bailey watched with a kind of horror. R. Daniil hesitated. He said, "The food is perfectly clean. I do not salivate or chew. It was drawn in through the gullet by suction, you know. It is edible."
"That's all right," said Bailey gently.
"I'm not hungry. You just get rid of it." R. Daniil's food sack was of fluorocarbon plastic, Bailey decided. At least the food did not cling to it. It came out smoothly and was placed little by little into the pipe. A waste of good food at that, he thought. He sat down on one bed and removed his shirt. He said, "I suggest an early start tomorrow."
"For a specific reason?"
"The location of this apartment isn't known to our friends yet. Or at least I hope not. If we leave early, we are that much safer. Once in City Hall, we will have to decide whether our partnership is any longer practical."
"You think it is, perhaps not?"
Bailey shrugged and said dourly, "We can't go through this sort of thing every day."
"But it seems to me..."
R. Daniil was interrupted by the sharp scarlet sliver of the door signal. Bailey rose silently to his feet and unlimbered his blaster. The door signal flashed once more. He moved silently to the door, put his thumb on the blaster contact while he threw the switch that activated the one-way transparency patch. It wasn't a good view patch. It was small and had a distorting effect, but it was quite good enough to show Bailey's youngster, Ben, outside the door. Bailey acted quickly. He flung the door open, snatched brutally at Ben's wrist as the boy raised his hand to signal a third time, and pulled him in. The look of fright and bewilderment faded only slowly from Ben's eyes. As he leaned breathlessly against the wall toward which he had been hurled, he rubbed his wrist. "Dad!" he said in grieved tones. "You didn't have to grab me like that!" Bailey was staring through the view patch of the once again closed door. As nearly as he could tell, the corridor was empty. "Did you see anyone out there, Ben?"
"No. Gee, Dad, I just came to see if you were all right."
"Why shouldn't I be all right?"
"I don't know. It was Mom. She was crying and all like that. She said I had to find you. If I didn't go, she said she would go herself. And then she didn't know what would happen. She made me go, Dad."
Bailey said, "How did you find me? Did your mother know where I was?"
"No, she didn't. I called up your office."
"And they told you?" Ben looked startled at his father's vehemence. He said in a low voice,
"Sure. Weren't they supposed to?"
Bailey and Daniil looked at one another. Bailey rose heavily to his feet. He said, "Where's your mother now, Ben? At the apartment?"
"No, we went to Grandma's for dinner and stayed there. I am supposed to go back there now. I mean, as long as you're all right, Dad."
"You'll stay here. Daniil, did you notice the exact location of the floor communo?"
The robot said,
"Yes." "Do you intend leaving the room to use it?"
"I've got to. I've got to get in touch with Jesse."
"Might I suggest that it would be more logical to let Bentley do that?
It is a form of risk, and he is less valuable."
Bailey stared.
"Why, you..."
He thought, "Jehoshaphat, what am I getting angry about?" He went on more calmly.
"You don't understand, Daniil. Among us, it is not customary for a man to send his young son into possible danger, even if it is logical to do so."
"Danger?" squeaked Ben in a sort of horrified pleasure. "What's going on, Dad? Huh, Dad?"
"Nothing, Ben. Now, this isn't any of your business, understand? Get ready for bed. I want you in bed when I get back, you hear me?"
"Oh, gosh. You could tell a fellow. I won't say anything."
"In bed. Gosh."
Bailey hitched his jacket back as he stood at the floor communo, so that his blaster butt was ready for snatching. He spoke his personal number into the mouthpiece, and waited while a computer 15 miles away checked it to make sure the call was permissible. It was a very short wait that was involved, since a plainclothes man had no limit on the number of his business calls. He spoke the number code of his mother-in-law's apartment. The small screen at the base of the instrument lit up, and her face looked out at him. He said in a low voice, "Mother, put on Jesse." Jesse must have been waiting for him. She was on at once. Bailey looked at her face and then darkened the screen deliberately. "All right, Jesse. Ben's here. Now what's the matter?" His eyes roved from side to side continuously, watching.
"Are you all right? You aren't in trouble?"
"I'm obviously all right, Jesse. Now stop it."
"Oh, Lige, I've been so worried."
"What about?" he asked tightly.
"You know, your friend."
"What about him?"
"I told you last night. There'll be trouble."
"Now that's nonsense. I'm keeping Ben with me for tonight, and you go to bed. Goodbye, dear." He broke connections and waited for two breaths before starting back. His face was gray with apprehension and fear. Ben was standing in the middle of the room when Bailey returned. One of his contact lenses was neatly pocketed in a little suction cup. The other was still in his eye. Ben said,
"Gosh, Dad, isn't there any water in this place? Mr. Oliver says I can't go to the personal."
"He's right, you can't. Put that thing back in your eye, Ben. It won't hurt you to sleep with them for one night."
"All right."
Ben put it back, put away a suction cup, and climbed into bed.
"Boy, what a mattress!"
Bailey said to R. Daniil, "I suppose you won't mind sitting up?"
"Of course not."
I was interested, by the way, in the queer glass Bentley wears close to his eyes. "Do all Earthmen wear them?"
No, just some, said Bailey absently. I don't, for instance.
For what reason is it worn?
Bailey was too absorbed with his own thoughts to answer. His own uneasy thoughts.
The lights were out.
Bailey remained wakeful. He was dimly aware of Ben's breathing as it turned deep and regular and became a bit rough. When he turned his head, he grew somehow conscious of R. Daniil, sitting in a chair with grave immobility, face turned toward the door. Then he fell asleep, and when he slept, he dreamed. He dreamed Jesse was falling into the fission chamber of a nuclear power plant. Falling and falling. She held out her arms to him, shrieking, but he could only stand frozenly just outside a scarlet line and watch her distorted figure turn as it fell, growing smaller, until it was only a dot. He could only watch her in the dream, knowing that it was he himself who had pushed her.